You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
Good morning and welcome to M Pavilion 10 by Tadeo Ando. And this is the very first public event, which we're very pleased to be collaborating to create. So today with the Yarning Circle, it's come from another project that the Naomi Milgram Foundation creates, the Living Cities Forum, which occurred yesterday, which I produced for them. And David Fortin, who is a First Nations architect from Canada, who came as a keynote speaker and presented yesterday. And some of the ideas that I was reading about from his work and how they resonated with the program that has taken place here and much of the other work that Sarah Lynn over the years and Bradley Kerr now produce with the M Pavilion called Blackitecture. So Sarah Lynn is a First Nations architect at JCB and also academic at Monash University and I collaborated with so many people, but very much with us. We've worked together since 2017 in a range of different projects. David, as I was saying, is at the University of Waterloo and is also a practicing architect and working extensively with First Nations communities, co-design of community of housing and other community infrastructure. And Bradley's also a practicing architect and is working with a major project at the moment in consultation. It sounded like it was a very complex set of stakeholders there. To start things off, Sarah is going to acknowledge country and situate our conversation.
Thanks, Sam. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to read this, which is not something that I would normally do, but I've taken a bit of time to prepare an acknowledgement about this place and the depths of time of this place. So I'm going to ask you to use your imaginations and close your eyes and just listen. It'll probably be about 5 minutes. A place that is older than the concept of time and as young as our memories. Collective histories held in the stories of the creation of the river and the bay. Stories that heed lessons about how to be in this place over time. Connected to the depths of the earth through the layers of geological time, intersecting with landscapes created and recreated through the formation of soils, our DNA, and through the passage of water slow and fast. Below our feet, geologies hundreds of millions of years old speak of a time when this place was underwater, an ocean and then a delta. To our east and north were abundant wetlands, giving seasonal rise to life as the river rightly rose and fell, bringing freshwater nutrients from upstream and saltwater nutrients from the mighty ocean. To our south is a sandstone rise, which marks the beginning of the sand belts that reach down the extent of the bay, sand belts crafted by winds of more arid times, when the bay was a river snaking through the heads. From the soil of the earth grew tall grasses that dance in the wind, woodlands filled with blackwoods, she oaks and wattles. High over our heads, dappled light streams through a canopy of distantly spread tall river red gum and manna gum trees, teeming with birds singing their songs during the day and possums ruling the night. A place of salt and fresh, a meeting place of many life forms. Water birds, fish and eels play in the wetlands of the river as the sun rises and glistens the land. The river filled with morning mist lives out her right to rise and fall, to be home, to be healthy, to nurture, to destroy, to carve and recarve her path. As the elders say, a river of her lands and her lands of her, a river of her rivers. A place that has cared for those that have cared for her since time immemorial. A place not yet controlled and made rigid by Western intervention. A place that has been stripped of her markers, her resources, her identity as nurturing home to all living things and natural systems. Controlled, shaped, infilled, widened, dredged, reflected through timber, glass, concrete, brick and steel, and littered with foreign ecologies that speak of faraway places. The never silent movement of people and their infrastructures, the ever bright lights confusing day and night. The home of a nation and their neighbours, to a home for global nations too disconnected from a culture of care and responsibility. Imagine a city that developed but never turned its back to country. Imagine a city that balances the rights of humans with the rights of waterways, animals, and insects. Imagine architectures that allow you to read country in their siting, form, materiality, and expression. Imagine architectures that give as much as they take. Imagine architectures that are country, informed by the science of law. I pay my respects to this country and to the elders that hold the memories of this place in their stories, spirit, and generosity. They have been ignored for far too long. They deserve to be heard, and it is our job to listen and act in alignment with the values, rights, and laws of the places that we reshape. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. There's a certain conversation that I had a sense of having a lot of fertile ground to explore today that came out of my reading of some of David's work and the work that we've done with Sarah over the years. So I thought as a starting point, it'd be great to explain why we're sitting in a circle and how that came to be a way that we did the architecture program, and then I'll ask David to talk a little bit about the other aspect.
Thanks, Sam. So I think Blackitecture started out of a regional program in 2017, and at the very end of that program we brought to this place in, I think, the OMA iteration of the pavilion, I think eight First Nations architects from all around Australia. And we had a big yarn about, I guess, the context of the time and the similarities across all of our experiences, and it became evident from that conversation that we really needed to have more conversations. And that pavilion, interestingly, sort of set you up in this idea of a circle, but also it was broken. And then over time we started to have these conversations. Every season we would do 3 to 5 talks, and they would cover all various different aspects of country and culture and working in architecture and our responsibility as practitioners to country through that context. And each time we sort of tried different things. I think once we had a circle in the centre and everyone sitting around, but it felt kind of weird. And then there was one where we had a stage and we didn't have a choice. And then there was one a few years ago where we sort of had free rein to do whatever we wanted to do. And so we created the circle. And the circle is really important because it doesn't have a hierarchy. So if you're sitting at the back, I encourage you to come and sit in the circle. Because it's about the fact that we're not up here on a stage. We're not on a pedestal. The idea is that we're all part of this conversation and we all get a chance to speak and we all get a chance to say something and understand or listen and then, I guess, declare what we will take away from this conversation in our own lives.
Yeah, and the only reason we end up over here is the technical reality that to record it, we need to use microphones. A little bit of sound reinforcement we think is helpful, but we have to sit behind the speakers for that. So otherwise we would actually be distributed around. So thanks. And so with that in mind, I'd been reading about David's work and your research project around the Design Lodge. And perhaps if you unpack that, I think it'll become clear that there's a resonance there.
Sure. So first of all, thank you for the invitation to be here, and thank you, Sarah, for your territorial acknowledgement. That was a great way to start the day. Okay, so I guess to Sam's point, I'm trying to think of how to package it really tightly, but essentially I've been teaching Indigenous design studios for a number of years now, and we often work with First Nations communities with the students in different locations. And you probably, if you know architectural education, if you don't, studio is kind of the term used pretty much around the world now. In fact, a lot of architecture offices also call their architecture offices studios. Art studios, even film studios, you know, this is a word that we use all the time. But what I found was when I was working with communities and I brought in First Nations people to the university and they came into the space of the studio, whether that be for final reviews or for just looking at how the arrangements were in the desks and just the physical space of the studio, there was a certain discomfort in the space. I mean, they're out of their comfort zone in many ways, but also the space wasn't set up for things like gathering in circles often. There was also a lot of hierarchies, our studio environments often look like big factory outlets where students are all at their desks and at their computers and hunched over, and there's qualities of the space. And I started to ask myself, well, why do we call it a studio? Like, what is the nature of studio? And why am I struggling with this? And why, I was feeling like, why am I calling it an Indigenous design studio in a university? It's kind of like taking concepts and ideas and philosophies from way outside of the academy and trying to shove them and contort them into this academic thing, which we just take as a norm. And the realization that I've had is that there's nothing about that needs to be what it is. We take way too much for granted. And so we've been very fortunate in our school when we established the School of Architecture in Laurentian in Sudbury, where we were the first program in the world that had built a curriculum based on Indigenous knowledge. From first year through till sixth year, there was not like an option where you could like, oh, I'm really interested in Indigenous issues, I'm going to take it. If you studied any course, structures started with birds' nests and then to wigwams, the structures of the Ojibwe people of the region. And then you kind of learned about architecture from there out. If you learned about history, architecture history starts with the creation stories and then branches out. So those students are given that kind of curriculum. We have an elder in residence in the building. So, you know, we saw certain things happen with an elder, a First Nations elder in the school all the time. And the story I like to share with people is one time there were pinups and there was an architect on his ego having a bad day and was ripping them apart one by one. Just, oh, you should really reconsider being an architect. There's a terrible drawing. This is awful. Just one by one. And then they stopped for a break. And our little elder, who's about 4 feet tall, I'm not kidding you, she's tiny, and she just patiently went over to him as he was at the water fountain and tore a strip out of him and told him that you are not respecting the spirit of these people who have put a lot of effort into this. And anyway, so we banned him from the school after that. And it just showed that there is an ethics to First Nations teachings and the way you deliver things that is different than what we consider okay in architecture. And it's really hard within the kind of constraints of both education and practice, the way it's set up right now, to think about how you deconstruct that. So the Design Lodge is kind of this idea of what happens if you take the way you make architecture and you learn it, forget about everything we know about studio, and put it into a lodge environment where the values and teachings of the elders are the guiding principles. And what happens with an architecture that emerges in that environment? And so where it sits right now is I'm kind of nudging my new university towards, like, in my opinion, you can kind of make shift in different spaces, or you can actually commit to it and build an actual purpose-built design lodge for architectural education built on Indigenous values. And the concept then is that it wouldn't be one kind of design lodge, because a design lodge here, or whatever you would call it here, would be very different than the one on the territories where I live, would be very different to the ones in Western Canada. So Design Lodge is a concept that responds to the Indigenous peoples of place and sets us up for, I think, like, what I'm trying to look at is the infrastructural way we think of how we build. Everything we're doing right now is going to be very short term. With climate change, we all want to address climate change. Everybody wants things to change right now. Like Indigenous knowledge, it's just not like that. It's going to take generations. So you have to plant the seeds at the education level, and then those students graduate, and then it's like hundreds of years down the road, we might see a transformation.
That sense of time is one that I think is a recurring lesson for me when I listen to conversations like this, a perception of time that transcends, and it's empowering and daunting for me. Yeah. Bradley, we were speaking briefly before about your current project, which sounded incredibly complex. And I know it's a bit of a short run-up on this question too, but in that university environment, that feels very clear as a structure to understand it. I imagine that's in contrast to what you're needing to try and make work collaboratively in the environment you're working in now.
I'm really curious with your studio. I kind of just have a lot of questions and they sort of relate. I don't know how to ask it, but it relates a lot to the work that I do. Sitting between translating the way that we're taught architecture and the way that we're taught to have conversations about architecture within practice or within studio, in contrast to how we would have conversations with people who aren't architects, and in particular people who are traditional owners. And I know that in Australia, First Nations language tells us a lot about place. Language reveals a lot about where we are. I'm really curious, sorry, and I know this isn't probably answering your question exactly, but the language in the way that your teaching, or the way that, the 6 years of studies Has the language of architecture changed, or have you noticed any kind of change about how you talk about it or how it's taught?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think your comment on language is huge. To me, it's actually one of the greatest challenges for Indigenous people is language. I'm not a language speaker. I don't think there are actually any real language speakers in Canada that are Indigenous architects. People know words and phrases and these sorts of things, but to be fluent. So I think that is core. But I guess to answer your question, one thing is, and I go back to the first one that I taught, actually, which is still in some ways the best example of, I think, what's possible. But one of my colleagues had sat in, and so, sorry. I like to claim this is the first time in Canada, because I invited Chris Cornelius and Patrick Stewart and Aladia Smoke and Jake Chakasm, and then we had elders there. So I think it might have been the first time in Canadian architectural education history that there was a full panel of Indigenous people critiquing work with a community of work on the wall. And it was great at so many levels. To Sarah's earlier point, we're often like the one Indigenous person on a panel, right? So then everyone else has their comments, and then they're like, okay, you get to now comment from an Indigenous perspective. And whether you're an expert of that Indigenous culture or not, like, it somehow falls on you to represent all Indigenous people. It's like, that's not possible. But I loved it because there was debate amongst the Indigenous architects, you know? One of them would say, well, that's, you know, you shouldn't use that symbol. That's a bit over, you're overdoing it or whatever. And then another architect would say, no, he's not. Like, that's our symbol. We need to put it up there, right? So that people are having conversations about what's kitsch and what's not, and really productive Indigenous design conversation. And at the end of those studio reviews, another colleague who's not Indigenous had kind of sat in the back row the whole time, and he came up to me after, and he said, I wanted to sit through today to see if there was a kind of conversation happening that I couldn't jump into and be a part of and like kind of feel like I had a voice in. And he said, that did happen. He's like, he said, everything about the conversation was not something I could easily jump into and talk about from my expertise. So when you create space for Indigenous perspectives, the language of architecture, using English, unfortunately, in our case, there is a different conversation about, you know, like even just the other day, one of my, your Australian colleagues over dinner was saying to me, we were talking about Indigenous architecture, and this is something I hear quite a lot. She said something, yeah, but you know, it generally doesn't turn out very good, right? Like, it's not good design at the end of the day. And I hear that a lot, and it's kind of, yeah, but then I'm like, well, it kind of, you know, it depends on what metrics you're using, right? Like, Patrick Stewart is a really good example. For those of you who don't know his name, he's a NISCA architect, and he does a lot of things like with communities that are really low budgets, but he's not afraid to, if the community says, well, let's make our rock here in the center look like a fire, so we can sit around a fire like we used to, and we're going to polish it up, and it's going to be a red burning flame color of rock, then he's done that in a project. And the community loves it, but every architect comes into it and says, that is so cheesy, like, you know. And in fact, he had one of the leading publishers of architecture magazines in North America went up to Patrick. He's written about this. And she said to him, you know, yeah, congratulations on your work. I would love to include some of it, but it just doesn't have the look that the architectural world wants. You know, no one's interested in your work, basically, because it looks kind of generic. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but it's sort of a few of those things addressing it.
That's fascinating, and it reminds me of something that we were talking about just before. It goes back to an earlier black architecture conversation that you had with Auntie Carolyn about the need to hold multiple systems in your mind at once and not zero in. I'm looking to you because I think that would likely resonate with some of the projects, and I'm even thinking of an award-winning project that just won an award this week. That there's times where it's been recognised for similar innovation and foregrounding of ideas that came out of engagement.
I'm trying to think which project you're talking about.
Sorry, the domestic, the women's.
Oh, the family violence.
The family violence, yeah.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to that because there's sort of, well, I can speak to it to a certain degree. I think that particular project is very interesting in the context of what you're talking about because it's a space that has to respond to so many things. But often when you think about something that has to respond to so many things, it becomes eclectic and maximalist. And I'm not saying those are bad things, but like that's where people's minds tend to go. But perhaps another way of thinking about this is, which is a way I've been trying to explain I guess, the difference between Indigenous and non-Indigenous worldviews from my own observation. This isn't Indigenous knowledge, this is just my observations, is that, and I spoke about this at the National Conference a couple of weeks ago, so sorry if you were there and already heard it, but when I find that non-Indigenous people start to engage in this space, in this conversation, they get overwhelmed because there is so much that they don't know and that they don't understand. And then their defense mechanism when you're overwhelmed is to go back to something that you know and process as usual and to find every reason and justification as to why something can't be done because you don't know how to do it. And like, it's a growing space and we're all figuring out how to shift the system so that we can work in it and it can be done in the right way for community and for country. But the way that I try to explain this is that if you imagine a sort of cone and from this sort of sense of overwhelm, you're starting at the widest point and you're looking at everything all at once and it's too much. Whereas, and that's how non-Indigenous people tend to interface with the idea of Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous ways of being, and then they get scared of doing the wrong thing and then they just don't do anything. Whereas from an Indigenous worldview, and I feel like this comes back to our kinship systems and our relationship to place, and I'm speaking generally, obviously it's different in different places, but we would sort of start from the other end, from the pointy bit, and we would find a way in. And that way in for me might be a magpie. For somebody else, that might be the geology. For somebody else, that might be... It's the one thing that allows you to relate to a place first. And then from there, it's almost like you have exhaled and your body is getting prepared for this notion of learning, and your lungs are preparing to take in the blood from your heart to oxygenate it so you can take in more and you can expand out to that bigger worldview, the sort of bigger surface of the cone. And so you start with the one thing and then you understand how that one thing is related to everything else that it's related to, and then you end up in this big space where you've breathed in and then you breathe out again and you're somewhere else. And then you do the whole process again. And then if you just keep going through this process, and this is coming back to your question about holding multiple spaces in your head at the same time, if you keep this process of breathing in and breathing out and coming back to one point and seeing how that point's related to everything, eventually you close the whole circle and you can navigate through how to evolve a design out of that process or evolve a way of thinking out of that process. But I think too often people get to that first point of overwhelm and then they can't see any further. And so I tend to call this sitting in the grey, and this notion that you don't actually have to come up with an answer so quickly. I actually tell off my directors for drawing too quickly, which is quite fun. But, you know, the idea of drawing on a blank piece of paper with an idea, and I know that some people draw to understand, and I'm not telling you you shouldn't do that, but like for me, you have to, you can't, The second you make a decision by drawing a line on a piece of paper, you've already negated a whole lot of things if you haven't sat and just felt and connected and thought and worked through the complexities, because it is complex. And I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of the way that I see that we actually have to change the way that we process and change the way that we think, and internally first before we then change the processes of architecture. Although we are trying to change the processes of architecture at the same time.
Well, kind of, you need to change the processes to allow this space to exist. Yesterday in the Living Cities Forum, the discussions from seven different voices from around the world had a number of commonalities, which was the reason we brought them together. But one was a resistance to this binary decision-making, that you have to have a contest of ideas where there's a loser. But you have this grey, you have this middle ground, and the end point, the solution, the final result is actually almost a distraction. It's the process and it's a much bigger perspective. So it seems to me that that's what comes out of these different models, but then they need to deploy effectively in real world. When before you were talking, Bradley, I thought you were going a certain direction. I wonder whether there's something in this nature of how you're educated and then in practice that's like a whole other world. And as you're referring to, like, it becomes too hard is maybe one nice way to put it. And another is that you're trying to represent lots of different competing voices and be effective in that way. And time is kind of seems a battleground. Like, why does it have to happen so fast we can't decide properly? And why does it have to be a decision that's final? I was really struck when you said 300 different constituents. And
yeah, one of the challenges that I find on a daily basis is I love to sit in that grey space. I love to take time, but large engineering projects don't let you take time. Large infrastructure projects don't really let you take time. So how do you create space for the ongoing, I guess, cultural uplift that's needed, or the ongoing trust that's needed that we'll reach an outcome. Like, an outcome's going to happen, something's going to be built. But we need to go through a process of first getting to understand each other so that we can work together appropriately. We need to get to a point where we all understand our own position on the country or the piece of, you know, the area of country that we're working on. And we need to have conversations around how we're all connecting with that area on country. And it's such a different way of working that it often doesn't fit within the system that's already been designed. And people, it takes a lot of kind of mental juggling to reach a position where people are willing to go through that, even if they say, you know, even if they have a reconciliation action plan and they've had cultural training and they've gone through all these processes, it's still actually enacting that in practice is really challenging. And I think it does stem a lot from education. I think it stems a lot from the language that we use to describe architecture and how we talk about architecture and how we talk about practice. And I love that you talk about things as studios. I always refer to them as practices because mm-hmm. I feel like that's a really appropriate word for what we're doing. We're constantly practicing how we intersect with country and how our projects intersect with country. I have no idea where I'm going with this. But
it seems to me that as you're talking, that it really exposes the short-sightedness of the urgency, that something that's urgent, a massive piece of infrastructure, presumably could last hundreds of years to enable a technology that's turned up seconds ago that's not even sustainable to use. It's like, it seems insane, and I think that that's kind of the work we've got to do. Now, one of the things about the Yarning Circle, if I just say that is the only reason we have the microphones really is for the recording, and we would really welcome participation. And there are some people here I know, so I might even nominate like Rory and Mel, that I imagine that you would have maybe some thoughts on what you're hearing and how that might reflect whether it's in the university system or some of the things that you've observed, in which case I'll scuttle over the microphone so we can catch your comment. I'm going to come over to you, Rory.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, everyone. Sarah, Bradley, David, fantastic discussion. And David, loved your presentation yesterday over here as well. I haven't prepared a question, Sam, but I've got some notes here and some thoughts. And maybe this idea of the design lodge, of the studio lodge, of displacing. I'm coming from a university perspective, and as a teacher and as an architect, and really interested in how we question this idea of the studio and all of the assumptions that it brings with us that go often unquestioned. And I'd love to hear a bit more about your concept of the studio lodge, but also Sarah and Bradley, any other experiments that you're having, keep the microphone, any other experiments that you're making in, you know, questioning those ways of teaching and how do we educate architects to think differently and how do those structures of the studio constrain our thinking in those ways as well?
So thank you for the question. And I mean, there's quite a bit that I dove into on this, but really, in a short version, the idea of studio, architects weren't always trained in studios. It really is a Renaissance thing. This is with the rise of humanism and the rise of universities. And you know, the root word of studio is, goes like studiousness and that idea of what is to study. So if you look at the first paintings in the Renaissance of what a studio was, it's always like a white man sitting in kind of a building surrounded by books with his pen. And he's either drawing or he's writing something. But it's this idea that the more knowledge you read of course, the ancients, and the more philosophy you bring, that gives you the sensibility to now redesign the world. And, you know, it kind of unfolds from there, this idea. It just ends up with Versailles, right? Like, you can rebuild the world to whatever you need to suit the Da Vinci's man in the circle sort of thing. Man is at the center of everything. So the before that, we worked in workshops. In Italy, there were bodegas, and throughout Europe there. And it was a mentorship program where you worked with your hands and you learned how to build, you know, the Gothic cathedrals. There was no education to learn how to be an architect. You had a mentorship program. Very actually more and more similar to indigenous ways of teaching. Like, in order to build buildings, you would have, as a child, learned from your uncles or your, actually the women in North America were the lodge makers. So they would have taught you in this process. And, you know, I mean, if you think about the difference of that, like, for instance, the Cree teepees. This is similar in very traditions, but each teepee pole has a key teaching to it, whether it be courage or bravery or whatever. And what I always think is so interesting about the teepee is they were mobile, right? You followed the buffalo across the prairies and you set up your teepee every time. Well, the grandmothers would have been there every time you set up your teepee. And as a child or a person helping out, you would have been repeated your value system. There was an ethics. So the building, if you call it that, is actually a framework for ethical learning. It regrounds you on where you are every time you put up the building, right? So, and those stories are all the, whether you do a sweat lodge or you build a birch bark canoe. And so a lot of these teachings on how we build birch bark canoes with our students in Laurentian, because, you know, what you learn when you make a birch bark canoe is they're not an object. And at the end of making a birch bark canoe, you give it a name. You have a naming ceremony. It becomes part of your community. And when the birch bark canoe has had its life, you simply walk it back into the forest and lay it down, and it goes back to Mother Earth, right? And, like, it's such a poetic example of what architecture could be. And so different that in how you translate the knowledge is actually as you're making, you're learning about the philosophy, you're learning about the relationship between the built world, you, and the living world. It's all there. Right, as a different way of learning, and very much different than the studio. And the other thing that happened with studio, as it emerged like 19th century into the 20th century, it also got complicated in a way, because it also started to be about architectural production, and coinciding with industrial production, coinciding with the emergence of art galleries. And one of the things that I thought that was so interesting, if you look at how a lot of studios and kind of conventional architectural design is, the relationship between the art gallery and the architectural office almost look the same. And they're really neutral vessels, which is what I wrote about in the Design Lodge. They have to be neutral vessels. It's kind of, you know, no offense to Tadeana, which I love, but like they're concrete floors and white walls and usually squares so you can put paintings on, because they need to adapt to everybody's ideologies. So the space itself, totally neutralized, meaning it's all-inclusive. It's an inclusive artistic space. But the studio is kind of the same, right? It's for many good reasons. It's an inclusive space where anybody from any background can show up in a studio and do their design work there, and then they can leave. But the studio itself is like a space of neutrality. But in that neutrality, we also accept how many other things are we losing in terms of those teachings that are possible, the building as a didactic place of learning. So neutrality has got a double-edged sword to it, because it's also a space of erasure. Right, so it's a complicated thing, and that's where the kind of the fight back against the regionalists against the modernists and all this. Like, people like to say, well, we're not, you know, architects think this is apolitical. Well, I don't want to get involved in politics. Like, I just do good design, right? This question of, well, it's not very good design, right? Why? Because it's actually trying to communicate something to you, that is, right? But often for many architects, it's like the less storytelling in a building, the cleaner the concept, the cleaner the idea, then it becomes more about you and your perception of the space, but it also becomes more and more neutral. And it's a form of erasure of indigenous cultures around the world. You can't deny that.
Yeah, that was a very thorough explanation that got all the way through to what I was hearing, that the ethics are still there. It's not without ethics, yeah.
I think in the Australian context, we obviously have a very long way to go in the context of design studios and architectural teaching, and we have had the opportunity to change the NSCA, the National Standards of Competency for Architecture. But that document, while that's a huge success and a lot of Indigenous people worked on incorporating 8 First Nations principles into it, that is a baseline minimum 50% pass rate standard, right? So a lot of universities are struggling to incorporate even those 8 principles. We started with 23. So, you know, I think it would be quite fun actually as an exercise, and maybe we should do this, Bradley, is to just like come up with an entire curriculum that is not beholden to any of those systems to see how it would be different. I think like what you were talking about with St. Laurentian. Yeah. Laurentian. I've definitely looked at that before and gone, oh my God, what a dream. You know, we did a study a couple of years ago and looking at Australia as a whole. This is probably 2017. And this was just a desktop study looking at every architecture course in Australia to understand where they're teaching Indigenous content, or if they are, and if it is core content or if it's an elective. And there was only one university in all of Australia that had one core subject that talked about country. And so obviously that is going to change because of the systemic change with this document. But that doesn't mean that you're going to shift the entire way of thinking about architecture, as David's talking about. So I think we have a very, very long way to go.
Can I just add to what you're just saying? Because I think there's something new that's emerging in Canada, which is kind of brand new, kind of hot off the press this week, actually. I mean, it's been building up for a couple of weeks, but one. So I think there's a whole bunch of different levels of this. And to your early point about non-Indigenous people in the space of Indigenous architecture, I mean, my experience has been that most people, not all, but a lot of people are genuinely wanting to be and understand the space. And in Canada, I think more so than here, one of the issues that we deal with is actually exclusionary knowledge, in a sense, that a lot of First Nations people feel like, you know, I've heard people say this before, that every time we've been generous, somebody's taken advantage of us for 200 years. And so for us to share our knowledge with you, it doesn't feel right, right? Like there, some Indigenous people are pretty protective of that knowledge. It's changing a little bit, but so there's a space. So the lodge concept, and you mentioned, we talked about this earlier. One of the things that I liked about the word lodge is that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it links back to the Freemasons in Canada. And the Freemason Lodge, it's my budding thesis that the reason why, like, you know, I often said, why do we call sweat lodges in Canada sweat lodge? Like, why didn't we call it a sweat temple or a sweat? Like, why lodge? We also have elders' lodges. We have teaching lodges. So the word lodge is used around a lot in Indigenous circles, and it's usually kind of a sacred space. Whereas the English version of it is more like, you know, ski lodge. So I'm interested in the etymology of the word. But the one place where they intersect is the Freemason Lodge. And there's a book out there, it's very interesting, called Native American Freemasonry. And in the early days of settlement in North America, it's one of the few places where there was not, there was a consistent spiritual journey that they felt the Freemason Lodge was created around, where Indigenous people were welcomed into, as well as Blacks. And at that time in North America, that would have been unheard of, that the settlers would have been welcoming Blacks or Indigenous people. But the Freemasons did. And of course, the Catholics and the Protestants hated them, and they just villainized them, called them witchcraft. But if you look at the core of the Freemasons' teachings, which I'm not a Freemason, I don't know much about it, I have a full disclaimer, but their lodges, for instance, have east entries, west doors, they have symbology to them consistent with. So there was some similarity. They also don't believe in kind of a hierarchical spiritual position. There's some teachings in Freemasonry that talk about the oneness of all things, like the wording of it is very similar. So it's kind of this question that, again, that we're all of us here have some Indigenous roots. And if you look around the world, like, there's such a thing as Indigenous Europeans, right? Prior to Romans coming through, prior to the everybody wiping through, like, look at Celtic culture, there's a lot of similarities. The Samis, of course. And so all of us do have, and my belief, as other people do, many of us believe that that's what we're all searching for. That's what people are drawn to Indigenous culture in this moment in history. Because we understand there's something missing in us. Everybody feels the disconnect to the icebergs that I showed up, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody feels there's something, this is great, but something's not quite right inside me, and it's the disconnect. And so that so people gravitating towards Indigenous knowledge is part of this story. So like that's, to me, the difficult part is like, how do you navigate that conversation to move together while still protecting Indigenous communities to have their own space? So I guess when you were talking, Sarah, I was going to just say this is the new thing off the press. Went on a tangent there. But we're looking at this idea of how can we have a space in what we would say on the land, you guys would say on country, that is for Indigenous practitioners, Indigenous students to come to and get the land teachings, start to strengthen our own land knowledge, because many of us are living in cities and, you know, consumed by emails and public speaking engagements and everything else that we're trying to do, changing policies. You know, how much time do we have even to go and sit with an elder and do ceremony on land? So like Aledia, and there's a bunch of First Nations architects, and we need to first root ourselves and give the students that opportunity. So we're looking at, you know, you may have something like that in Australia and Canada. We have a thing called Ghost Lab that Brian McKay Lyons did, or there's various versions around the world where it's almost like a piece of land, and throughout the year it could do summer intensive, but really for us, like an all Indigenous space. And then in the universities, it's like that will strengthen what we bring to the universities and how we restructure curriculum. But we might not be able to do everything in one kind of way. I think there's a whole bunch of different seeds you can plant to make things change.
We don't have that space here, but it sounds nice.
Yeah, well, we can work on this together, I think, because I think every, you know, I think the Maori may have something like that, but I think it's something.
Uncle Dave walked on country with us a couple of days ago at Corindook, and last year he took our speakers to Dyett's Falls. And I'm not sure whether maybe Bradley or Sarah, you might know more about what he shared, so I can only share what he told me at the time. And that was how many First Nations people in Australia aren't on their own country. And that can be an incredibly distressing space to be in. And that there are some very important ways you can reinforce their sense of belonging. And then he asked us to look around where we were to see whether we could see it. And there are scar trees there, which if you're not looking for them, you don't know what you're looking for, you don't see. But if you're from another country, you're reminded that there is a connection there that you're part of. So I feel like I've gone out a little bit. This is the risky bit that you feel like as a non-Indigenous person, like, oh, I'm talking about something I shouldn't. But in sharing that with me and hearing what you're saying then, I'm wondering whether there is a starting point in that there are these moments where there are places that could be the starting point for what Dave is just describing. I'm looking to you, Bradley, because I thought you might have done some work with the Wurundjeri. No?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm still processing everything that all of the conversations that we've been having. I'm really slow.
I know.
It takes me a long time
to
hear things.
But everybody should slow down.
Yeah, it takes me a very long time to hear things and to try to understand them. And so when I have conversations with people, sometimes I'll just let them talk for a long time, and then half an hour later I'll ask them a question based on something they might have said 2 days ago. Australia, I think we have recently been having a conversation around what architecture is, and someone put it quite poignantly that architecture is inherently an act of violence. I'm not sure, I don't know exactly the relationship between architecture, the history of colonial architecture in Canada and the impact it's had on First Nations peoples, but in Australia, the impact that architecture's had has been huge. Like if you look at the cadastral plan map of Australia, and if you look at the separation between the states and the territories, and what the relationship is between the 500 language groups, however many different countries there are, you know, they're just straight lines cutting through it. If you look at the EVC classes in Victoria, and you overlay the rectangular plans, there's no relationship between the geology or the ecology of this place. And I think when we start talking about architecture with non-Indigenous people, I always find it really difficult to have conversations because I never really understand where they're coming from and why. And you mentioned something yesterday, which is Indigenous is in now. And I think I feel that on lots of projects, on lots of things that I'm working on, Indigenous is very much in. But where I'm still trying to understand if Australia has this really horrible history of erasure of culture and extraction of resources, are we going through something similar now where we're trying to erase the horrible histories and extract traditional knowledge so that we can reframe our cities and reframe how we teach and reframe what architecture is to this place, but we're not addressing core systemic issues. So I find it personally incredibly challenging. I love that non-Indigenous people want to be in this space. I mean, I'm probably one of the whitest people here, but, you know, I've got a complex history, a complex family history. We all have our own histories, and one of the things you mentioned was how did you arrive to this land? It's a really important question. So also, I'm always told that, you know, the white fellas are here now, so we need to move forward together. And Sarah, you talk about plurality. But for non-Indigenous people who are engaging with us and engaging in this space, what are you trying to get out of it? Are you trying to tell people, are you trying to express that you know heaps about Indigenous stuff? Are you, you know, this culture of extraction, it feels like it's ever present. And I'm trying to figure out now how to navigate that. And I think, sorry, I'm turning around to people who are also navigating that at the moment. It's definitely one of the biggest challenges that I'm facing. I don't know if I'm framing that as a question. It's more just a reading of the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. And we've been having a lot of conversations about this too, in the sense of like when you engage with traditional custodians, they're only used to being engaged on artworks in architecture or all of those sorts of things. It's not about the depth of the value system of that place. It's not about the rights of that country to live out in the way that it should be, the natural systems to actually be. It's not about the health and well-being of country, because nobody has ever asked them that before. And so it is actually quite challenging, because sometimes you go into these sessions and the traditional owners, who have every right to self-determine how they want to be represented in a place, will talk about art, and they will talk about bronze statues of their elders being placed in parks, and they will talk about all of these things. And it is a severe internal conflict, because you're like, no, it could be so much more. But like, that will just take time. It will take enough pushing and hard work on certain projects for people to realize that they can have more. But it also takes, I know someone's doing a PhD on this at the moment, but it takes someone creating a knowledge to share back with the traditional custodians about how architecture works, so that they are able to navigate and say no, yes, and these are the important parts in the process, rather than the sort of blind process that we typically go through now. We meet several times throughout a project and there isn't that kind of conversation. So I think there's, I don't know. The other thing I was going to say that's like I find super interesting watching even the practice that I work in over the course of the last sort of 7 years, and seeing a willingness to engage in the Indigenous space and putting their money where their mouth is in terms of creating resources and internal processes and ways of working. But then when it comes to a project, it's taken a long time to actually, and this is no one's fault, this is just how it's going to happen. It's taken a long time for people to realise that, like, a lot of our clients now are asking for Indigenous-led and what that really means. And, you know, there is some resistance sometimes because it might be about ego or it might be about whatever, but you know, one of the projects we've been working on this year, I think we finally had a really big conversation about Indigenous-led doesn't mean an Indigenous person is doing all of it and nobody else gets a say. Indigenous-led means that you operate in an Indigenous way with Indigenous guidance and that you recognise that within a community there are strengths in all different people and you bring those strengths together and you all have a hand in it and you all have a say. And I think once people realised that on this one particular project, which I can't talk about, everyone relaxed and, like, nobody was like, well, am I going to get to draw anything or am I going to get to be a part of it or, like, you know, like all of those ego things that people have inside of them, everyone realised that actually it's architecture is a collective act and when the values are set correctly in the first instance, then it can be this wonderfully joyous process that has an outcome that is better for country than when than the state of the country was in before. So, you know, I think there's hope. It just, it takes a very long time and every individual has to go through that reckoning and realisation process. And so working working within a bigger practice, it means that you actually have that sort of legacy of working with the same people over and over again. But working as a consultant to other practices is a whole other world of you only have one project. You don't have a every day with that person. And it must feel the same for traditional owners. They're sort of working project to project and they don't have that ongoing teaching unless you're continuously working on projects with them. So there's not this shared process of understanding of the way the world works but also how the world needs to change. So it's, I mean, it's a fascinating and interesting time, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I think going back to the first question just about language and about how we talk about architecture, I agree. Architecture can be so much fun and I love working with traditional owners and not having to use the type of language that we're taught within architecture school. It is a lot more fun when you're just trying to uncover a narrative of a place and why is this place important? What is the significance of it? You know, architecture, we're always taught to explore a local architectural vernacular. You know, you're talking about critical regionalism, which is the where we are in a place. And talking to traditional owners, it's about where we are, but it's also about who we are and who this country is and this whole relationship. So critical relationalism is such a lovely way to put it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, to your question about extraction, and I mean, the cynic in me, you probably got a feeling from that yesterday, is a lot of design firms, and it's not from a place of maliciousness. It is kind of an extractionist, though. Like, designers love things that excite them visually and that improve their design practice, and they can build up their portfolio, and this is kind of something new that's really old. But I think part of me, you know, that's a concern I have. But one thing I was going to share, and in addition to what you're saying, Sarah, and kind of your optimism about it, like, in Canada, one of the things that we always have to go back to is thinking about, there's twofold. There's, like, society. Well, there's actually many folds, but there's the society, the kind of coming together. Like, I heard Uncle Dave talk about Australians, right? Like, who are we as Australians? So there's, like, a national identity thing happening here, which is great. But, you know, one thing we always are asking ourselves in relation to your question of extracting, what are we up to here, is to check ourselves, like, are our communities prospering? Are our First Nations communities prospering? And that's why so many Indigenous people love, like, Wakanda, right? Afrofuturism and Indigenous futurism. And because I think, like, in 100 years, if that doesn't change, like, we need more and more Indigenous prosperity, however you frame that. So we can't, like, only focus on, like, the national narrative, because one of the things that I'm sure you've read Tuck and Wang's article, Decolonization is Not a Metaphor. If anybody's interested, it's a great essay. Read Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, because one of the things they talk about is, you know, everyone loves indigenization and to decolonize the world, but nobody wants to give up anything, right? Everyone still wants their raise. They want to buy another cottage. They want a new car next year. They want their lives to stay the same. As long as it's under those terms, everybody loves it. But the reality is, like, there's a reckoning that has to happen here. And Indigenous people in Canada, especially with our population base, I mean, it's the fastest growing population in the prairies, our First Nations peoples. I mean, I think it's a little different than here. Like, the city I grew up, Prince Albert, it's 35% Indigenous. So you got 12,000 people in that one city. You know, like, there's communities, and they're thriving. They have their own administration buildings. They have their own architectures. They have their own government systems. So, you know, the future means they thrive or nothing to me. like, let's drop the whole narrative and the initiative. If they don't feel the prosperity of this initiative, it's a lost cause.
It's kind of something that Sarah says a lot, which is, I guess, the idea that within architectural practice, people always want to see a visual outcome. Does it look Indigenous enough? Whereas whenever we're, and I get that all the time, and I feel that, and I have to check myself, you know, it's not about does it look Indigenous enough, but does it, what am I prioritizing here? And I steal Sarah's line all the time, sorry Sarah, but care comes first. We're always looking at how we can care for a place before we apply some kind of motif.
I mean, Tuck and Wang talk about a move to innocence, and that is such a powerful concept that they write about, which is this idea that if Melbourne looks more Indigenous in 15 years, then everyone's going to feel really a little bit better about themselves. You know, like, we did pretty good here. We're all holding hands together, right? It's a way of relieving some of the reality of the history. And that's what we're doing within Canada too. Is, so, you know, you're always back and forth. Am I being optimistic and forward-thinking, or am I part of this other cynical story?
We constantly talk about being in an existential crisis here every day.
Yeah. That's just the way that we operate is just a constant existential crisis.
I was just conscious of certain logistics of how to invite you to join the conversation. Great, that's one way. To include you in the...
I've got three questions. Some of them might be controversial, so just forewarning. Do you think the Melbourne Metro stations should have Indigenous names, like, is that a yes, no for the panel?
That's not up to us to decide. That's for the traditional owners.
Yeah, okay. And I found that most people that study architecture that want to engage in Indigenous architecture, there's no opportunity for them, so they just have to leave the profession. Is there anything on that?
I think we're trying to change the profession, but yeah, that's going to take a very long time and requires a lot of patience, but also requires people to get in and get involved.
Yeah, okay, cool.
To your first question, I mean, I can't make that judgment, obviously, neither can these guys, but I go back and forth on that because, again, it's this thing, is this a move to innocence or not? But we're seeing this happen in Canada, and it's got the double-edged sword, but I think it's very positive. I mean, you actually guys have a lot of different naming in Australia off of Indigenous names, and in general, I think that's a very strong way of naming things. We're seeing, I don't know if you're doing this here as well, but we're changing the names of lots of things, particularly people who are honored who probably don't have a very good history in terms of our Indigenous peoples. Their names are being removed off of buildings and universities, and streets and statues have been relocated. So I think it's an important part of the process.
Yeah, well, I think as we were talking about earlier, language is such an important, crucial aspect of First Nations culture. Yep. I know in Australia it is, and we use First Nations words to name lots of cities, yeah, places, because in our culture, our language talks less about putting a person on a pedestal and idolizing one person and idolizing an individual, but language tells a story of where you are. So when I introduce myself, Brad Kwandamuka from Minjeribah. Kwandamuka means people of the bay, and Minjeribah means place of many mosquitoes. And mosquitoes fucking love me.
I was just going to make a comment that in our, a lot of our First Nations languages, again, and we talked about this briefly at dinner, but like what amazes me is, and I'm going to probably butcher this so that I'm not a knowledge carrier, but for instance, the Anishinaabemowin language where I live, the phonetics of the sounds of the language are actually tied to different things in the environment. So if we're having a conversation throughout this conversation, if we were speaking in Anishinaabe Mumun, we would have all been reminding of the importance of, for instance, water, just because we would hear that sound in the way we're talking. In the prairies, certain sounds relate to the buffalo. So the sound, they have a kind of throat sound, right? And every time that comes up in a conversation, you're reminding of the importance of the buffalo. So like language is more than just a communication device. It is that part of that relationalism that ties it all together. And if you understand all the meanings of all the words, right? Like we have these great exercises where there's a word. We did this when we named our research institute, the Mamuzing Research Institute. We asked some elders, you know, can you help explain Mamuzing? It took like, I think there's a 7-minute video trying to explain the meaning behind the word. Right? Whereas we use words so quickly. But I also see that as another form of colonial imposition. It's sort of like the tip of the iceberg, again, mislocated. Like our words don't link us to anything other than each other. So language gets kind of flattened into how it can be used. And that's a major part of this issue that we're dealing with, is the language barrier.
My point is a bit back in the conversation, but maybe it goes to some of what you were talking about a minute ago. I think one thing about, I really enjoyed your talk, David, and this session's great, and so thank you for coming and contributing so generously. But I'm an educator, and one of the things that might go to this problem of Indigenous is in now, and it's a cultural load that we're demanding that's just out of proportion to what can be given and also progress and so on, is my personal teaching background has been always about relational practice, because I've always been critical of the fact that architectural education does exactly what you said, which is sort of speculate in a vacuum as a way of teaching and learning. So, you know, doing live projects, situating people out in places, and I do feel like these are things, there are models that we should structurally think about in terms of education. And I guess the challenge that we have, I mean, I do a lot of live projects out in the world. One of the problems we have is the structural problem of higher education with huge amounts of people, and how we can genuinely do something radically structurally with education. Now we have hundreds in degree courses. It's a deep frustration to me, because actually if you were learning out in the world in ways that might be more like the workshop, or in structures and infrastructures where it's not just about buildings but also mutual aid, infrastructures of making and resources, you would start to, you would pick up a relationality which would then give something to this this sort of issue. And I think so. I think our quandaries are the scale in which we now operate higher ed, and our unwillingness. I speak as a someone who's trying on this path. Our unwillingness, or sort of inability to radically restructure higher education into a sort of lifelong learning system, which doesn't require us to get somewhere in a semester, 3 years, 5 years.
Yeah, thank you so much for your comments, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, this is where my political lean will come out pretty obviously. But one of the things that I struggle with this as well. So, for instance, I was at Laurentian University. One of the reasons why I ended up at the University of Waterloo is because Laurentian University went bankrupt. It's the first university, public institution in Canada, to ever go bankrupt. And it ended up being kind of it's a right-wing government with a right-wing president of the university. And what happened is they ended up on a Tuesday morning just sent an email out to 120 faculty members and just said, you are no longer employed at the university. They just cut programs. And of course, everything that got cut was humanities, gender studies, Indigenous studies, and they kept mining, business, engineering, and I think there's a crisis going on with higher education as well, but it links more to the kind of extractive capitalist mode of being that is the world, because there's starting to be even a disconnect to the valuable education you're providing, right? And we hear this from our students often, like we're teaching architecture in a certain way, and then they go out into the field and they spend 95% of their time just drafting up, trying to figure out how to maximize space for condo developers to make more money in downtown Toronto. And they're like, I didn't really sign up for this, but this is the work that I have to do. Like there's all these disconnects between the profession and the way the economy works, and this kind of extractiveness it comes from resources, yes, and knowledge, but it's all linked to the idea, like, you know, I loved, who was it at the talk yesterday, and there was this quote from somebody else that said, might have been one of the African scholars, but like, you know, don't choose a major, figure out what change you're going to make in the world first. Like, our decision-making, I mean, we talk about this a lot with Indigenous people. No Indigenous group in the world that I've ever come across with has ever had private bedrooms for children. That, and even Europe, this didn't really, private rooms and private halls didn't really come into being until the 18th century, 17th, 18th century, somewhere in there, mainly in Holland. But, you know, that idea that you take your child, and I'm guilty of this, I'm not preaching to anybody, you put them in their room, you close the door, you let them cry it out in their crib so you can get your sleep, and then they're in their private room, they have to, right from that moment, be like, oh, I guess mom and dad aren't with me, I'm on my own. And then what do we teach them throughout their school? It's competition-based, you go in sports, you got to get first grades, class, 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 then you make a choice, where are you going to go? Oh, to the top university. Well, that means you might have to move from Melbourne to Sydney because this is the best program over in Sydney. Now you're making a decision not on your kin, not on your family, not on your relationship to place. You're making it on where you're going to get your best degree from. And you graduate from university, and then your next decision is, who's going to hire me to make the most money? And the world is like consumed by this idea of like individualistic, I'm going to make it, and I'm going to have this amazing lifestyle down the road. And it totally is perverse in terms of Indigenous teachings about what's really important. Like this question, what relations matter? Like the whole societies are built to constantly move you away from your kin. You know, David Harvey, I talked about him yesterday. David Harvey is one of my heroes because he talks about, you've seen my critique of capitalism here. But he says, capitalism builds itself. And I'll never forget that quote. Right, so we've got to forget it's not a person. There's a system in place here, and it builds itself, and it kind of contorts all of us to figure out how to navigate its system. And it is in direct opposition to Indigenous values, which would say, what is most important, my family, my sense of place? Douglas Cardinal gives a great lecture, and I'll just share this teaching with you. It comes from the elder William Commander, and it's a very simple teaching. But somebody was asking him at an event I was at, and they're asking similar questions. You know, how do we move forward, blah, blah, blah. And Douglas, if you don't know him, he's an elder in Canada. He's almost 90 years old. He's our most famous Indigenous architect. And he said, my elder told me we have two responsibilities. One, love and respect Mother Earth and take care of her. Two, love and respect each other unconditionally. If you ever make a decision in your life that goes off one of those two paths, doesn't mean you're bad, but you're on a crooked path and you just got to get back to that path. And if you can achieve those two things, we're all fine. But capitalism doesn't set us up to do that. We are making decisions, and myself included, many others. So anyways.
I was just going to say, what happens if you had an Indigenous faculty and you put architecture in that? How would that change the way that we perceived of the hierarchy of that space? Like, instead of being in engineering or instead of being in planning or instead of being in any of other these systems, I'm just curious, it's like a thought experiment in Indigenous context.
Yeah. Oh, kia ora koutou. Ko Taranaki te maunga, ko Wairika te awa, ko Tamaki Makaurau te papakainga, ko Kathy Aho. Just wanted to greet you on Te Reo Māori. I'm a tangata tiriti person from Aotearoa, and I really enjoyed your presentation yesterday and introducing your relations to your family before you spoke, so thanks for that. Just in response to that, Sarah, so before I shifted to Melbourne to join in this conversation as part of Monash, I was working for Huru Te Ao, the School of Future Environments at AUT in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. And there has been, so that new program, it's only 3 years old, an architecture program, and so because it's brand new, there has been this conversation as part of forming the program about where does this sit and how do we do things. The conversation was really difficult because the opportunity is to say it's a kaupapa Māori or Māori program, but in the space of the university, it was very hard to conceive that, and so it's now been understood as a kaupapa Māori-led program, but not in its entirety. And one of the things that I mean, it's been an incredibly good experience for me to work in that space. I've got, very, very dear colleagues working in that program. But one of the things that I began to question about what we were doing was, were we instrumentalising to our Māori knowledge? Because we were taking it and we were shaping it to fit the shape of the institution, to fit the 12-week semester, to fit the naming of units. So some of the things, I mean, it's all an experiment, right? It's all trying. And some of the things I think I'm completely conflicted, because on the one hand I think the fact that we call everything wānanga, which is a word for teaching and learning and schooling that isn't, it's from the Te Ao Māori word, the world. The fact that we were doing that, everything was wānanga, every teaching session began with karakia or, you know, in Te Ao Māori, all students, all core, no choosing in or out kind of thing. So on the one hand, I think, fantastic, felt very proud of what we were doing. On the other hand, I felt, oh, we're always shaping this to fit the institution. So, yeah, as you say, it's always a work in progress and an ongoing struggle. But I think felt very honoured to be part of something testing those boundaries all the time. Yeah, kia ora.
Thank you so much. I'm conscious that this great conversation is going over a provisional schedule. But I would invite any more comments. And something that you did that I think was really fantastic when we did the ironing circles in 2020, whenever I was 21, was at this point, pass the microphone around and invite you to share with us something that you will take away from today's conversation. And as we record that in our... It becomes part of our record of that, and in times to come, we hope that we can share that more broadly.
Yeah, I was just thinking, every time I come back to Melbourne I come to visit M Pavilion, I always seem to stumble across a Black architecture talk, which has been great, and likewise, it's been fantastic, and I've learned so much. And my takeaway is the idea of home, and the sense of home, and that competition for pursuit of something rather than, instead of focusing on those around you, family, sense of place.
We're probably in a very similar position. We're both from Melbourne. We've moved interstate for pursuit of career. So particularly that point of moving further away from kin, I've been very struck by, because I've been torn. I've got most of my friends and family in Melbourne. And being in Canberra, I feel very separated from them. So it's been a big part of, I want to be back down here more, but then the career opportunities I have in a smaller town where there's less competition has been something I couldn't ignore and I couldn't walk away from. So that particular point has been very poignant to me, especially today.
I would say I struggle too with structural systems. I'm trying to find my way. So today I'm living with trying to feel comfortable in the unknown, or feeling comfortable in uncomfortable.
Thank you. So I'm going to be taking away the pointy bit of the cone, which I have reworked in my mind to just starting relationally from where you are.
Thanks. I'm going to take away not drawing too quickly as well, and letting the place and the ideas marinate for longer before leaping into putting a line on the page. Thanks.
I'm going to take away, as someone who's a designer in architecture but doing some education as well, to really push younger designers to think about the process and the outcome rather than necessarily the visual outcome.
I'm going to take away starting small and allowing yourself to take the time to kind of figure things out and piece things together.
Thank you. I think I was here last time at one of the Black architecture talks with you, and it has been, I came down from Sydney as well, and it's been a complete highlight every time, and these moments and holding the space is so important. And I made a little thing about leaning in, and I felt I was certainly leaning in, and I felt everyone was, and that openness. And it's because of the generosity with which you've all given your time. And there's so many amazing moments that you've just sparked stuff about language, extractivism, questioning ourselves and questioning the systems. So thank you.
I think something that really struck a chord with me, one of the audience members was talking about the cultural load that we're kind of demanding at the moment. I think just maybe taking away that maybe in the pursuit of trying to understand, we shouldn't put that burden on our First Nations individuals to kind of, and or expect that sort of understanding and knowledge to be passed down. And like, do your Googles.
I guess I'm a bit of an outsider here, not an architecture. I'm a teacher, secondary school teacher. But there's so much that has made me think here, so much broad thinking and generosity on your part. So thank you for that. I also loved the cone as a way to approach so many things in life, not just design. And David, your beautiful idea of a really inclusive idea of everyone relating to something in First Nations culture and ideas. And I see that in my students so much. I think that's what's missing. So I really loved that thought. Thank you.
Thank you. My takeaway is remembering that I'm not an architect, but this conversation shouldn't just be for architects, and it's not. And that's what I'd actually like to see, how the M Pavilion conversations like this can welcome people outside of architecture, to listen, because it's all information that we need to hear and consider, and we can't wait until we decide what our profession's going to be and then hope that the university is going to teach us a way of including and considering Indigenous perspectives and culture and, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. I come from a planning background and I've worked on cultural heritage management plans, and this conversation has just brought up feelings for me in terms of how preserving can... So what happens in cultural heritage management plans is that you work on a project and you remove things of cultural heritage away from its land to preserve it, but this conversation has brought on for me that preserving comes from practice and not taking it away the context of cultural heritage. Oh, we're preserving it for what? To stay in a box in a storage facility, maybe in a museum? That's removing it from its context and removes it from its storytelling. So thank you for letting me to just, you know, reflect on that and, yeah, in terms of how that system works and how that's a problem. Yeah.
I think I'm going to reflect on this, much like yourself, in about 2 or 3 days' time. As I'm walking through a park, it'll be like, but what? If that's the case, and that's about all I'll have. And I'll have a question for you maybe in a couple of weeks' time.
Well, I think really because of the time more than anything, I feel we could talk for a lot longer. And I really appreciate the generosity of everybody who's participated, all of you being here with us, and Bradley and Sarah and David. And also any of the events that happen here, the Living Cities Forum, they are only made possible through partnerships. It takes a whole network of people, but today was particularly important that Monash University helped us make this happen. And it's also really great that Monash is your faculty as well in terms of where you work. So I'm very appreciative of their support. And Mel Dodd, who was here just before, she's also one of the advisors for the Living Cities Forum. So we're very fortunate to have these relationships, as we do with Dan Hill and the Melbourne School of Design. It's one of the nice things about working in this space has been this meeting of partners. And the Naomi Milcom Foundation, I'd just like to say thank you both personally, but also I think on all of our halves in terms of initiating this project and the Living Cities Forum, and the team at M Pavilion for hosting us today. So thanks very much. Like you, I've got so much to think about.
I just wanted to say thank you to you, Sam, because I know you're working collaboratively with Sarah, but it's just so important for Indigenous communities and peoples to have real, genuine allies walking down that path together. We say, you know, you've got your paddle in the water, in Canada. So, yeah, I just wanted to say really appreciate your enthusiasm and commitment to this. I think it helps move everybody.
Thanks. I think Black Architecture has shown that there's an awful lot of people who have optimism and enthusiasm to understand and grow together. So, yeah, but thanks. Thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to an MPavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.